Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Live from the Nasdaq Market Site in the heart of New York City's Times Square, this is Fast Money. Here's what's on tap tonight. Rising tides, yields, oil, gold, all up to start the new quarter and adding to their gains for the year. How markets are reading into these moves and what it could mean for the Fed this year. Plus, a currency crunch, the Japanese yen trading near 30-year lows against the dollar. What the move means and why one of our traders says we should be paying more attention to these swings. And later, digging in on DJT, the latest numbers on the former president's social media company. Just how much did it lose last year and what's it mean for valuations? I'm Melissa Lee, coming to you live from Studio B at the Nasdaq. On the desk tonight, Karen Feinerman, Dan Nathan, and Guy Adami. Powerful trio here. We start off with a big move in rates to start the second quarter. The 10-year Treasury yield rising 13 basis points in today's session, now hovering around 4.3%, a two-week high. It was below 3.9% at the start of the year. But it wasn't just yields moving higher today. Gold hitting another record during the session, settling above $2,200, and WTI crude surging to nearly $84 a barrel, hitting its highest level since late October. The move's coming after Fed Chair Jerome Powell suggested over the weekend that the economy is still on strong footing, potentially giving the central bank more time to weigh data before cutting interest rates. So does this all tell investors to prepare themselves for a prolonged pause from the Fed? Maybe we won't get three. Maybe it's more like two or one or none, as James Gorman has said.
I actually think that would probably be the most bullish thing that could happen, because it would suggest, although inflation is still a problem, the economy is fine. It can withstand rates at these levels. And quite frankly, we've learned that the market can withstand rates at these levels. So I think people are wishing for rate cuts. And I've said, be careful what you wish for. With that said, though, the inflation genie, I think, is right back out of the bottle in the form of all the things you mentioned at the top of the show. And the fact that gold is rallying with the dollar going higher and yields moving the way they're moving is really interesting and, I think, significant, Melms.
I agree with everything you said, that I think it would be that he's not raising rates because things are good and they don't need to. I mean, it would seem like this isn't a great time to start cutting. You want that dry powder when you need that dry powder, right? We don't need it right now. So I'm surprised there's still three on the table. I agree with your open. It could be two, could be one. Wouldn't be so shocking. Three to me is more surprising than zero, I would think.
Right. But to delve inside the mind of the markets, so to speak, aren't we rising? Aren't we doing so well because there are three on the table still? And if you took them away tomorrow and there's a headline saying Powell says no rate cuts this year, what would the markets do, do you think?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I go back to the fall. I mean, I really don't. When the when yields in the 10-year went from 4% to 5% in September, October, to the highs in late October, right? So the higher for longer narrative was like that was the consensus there. Look at what the S&P 500 did. It went from, it went from like 4,600 down to 4,150. I mean, think about where we are. We're at 5,250. So when I tell you I don't know, I have no idea. And so if we're going to soon price out a June rate cut, okay, and then that kind of pushes it into the summer, and then we have two at that point or so, like, I just don't, I have no idea, but like, the fact of the matter is, if the Fed keeps ratcheting up their GDP expectations, if we get through Q1 earnings season and we don't have a meaningful downgrade to at least guidance going forward, then I guess at some point there should be a little fear put back in the stock market, because we just haven't had a 2% down day in the S&P 500 in like 285 days or something like that. It just seems like there's a lot of complacency right now, but I think a lot of investors are like going to continue to ride this as long as they can, especially if they think the rally is broadening out a bit.
Well, didn't we go from, I don't know, 6 to 5 to 4 to 3?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's true.
Things were all right. That didn't seem to put people off the market. Certainly, some of the high flyer big multiple names, those did well anyway. So I don't really understand why there's such a push for him to cut. when when it's not clear the genie is back in the bottle.
S&P 500 earnings consensus for 2024 is like $243. We're at about 21 times, okay? So that is like very high relative to the 5 and 10-year average. I think FactSet has it down at like 19 and 18% respectively on those averages, right? So if we get to Q1 earnings season and we do see guide down, we have two very big names, Apple and Tesla. I know we're going to probably talk about both of them later. I mean, some analysts are expecting, well, right now, consensus is for a year-over-year decline in earnings growth for Tesla. If that were to happen in Apple, and then you start seeing that sort of deceleration in some other names, at some point, the stock market or investors will pay attention to that.
The other reason yields could be right, again, maybe the economy is great. The other reason, and we've talked about this, is the fact that issuances are coming out in a major way, I think close to somewhere between $9 and $10 trillion by the end of this year. And not to suggest that people won't buy our debt, they absolutely will. But the market's going to demand a higher rate of interest to do that. And I think to a certain extent, you're seeing it now. And over the weekend, you're reading more and more stories about debt to GDP and how at a certain level, things sort of get on the wrong side that you can't recover from. And the fact that interest payments on this debt have reached a staggering number for this year. I think the bond market is taking that into consideration as well. That's not particularly bullish for the market, however, in my opinion.
I mean, that's one of the reasons why we see gold rising,
I believe so,
as we do. When that haven, as Ben Evans wrote today, and, you know, he wrote basically, when you see one haven not acting properly, that's when gold really shines. And that's exactly what we've seen over the past, you know, month or so plus. In terms, though, of the historic valuation of the S&P 500, some could argue, though, that historic valuations are not applicable to where we are now because the composition of the S&P 500 is so different.
Well, I'd make the argument, though, if you think about where we've been getting earnings growth over the last year, why we bucked this kind of like earnings, you know what I mean, kind of malaise that you've seen across lots of other sectors is because of the mega cap names, the names that make up 30% of the S&P 500, that make up 50% of the NASDAQ 100. If you did not have the outperformance from an NVIDIA that's been growing 100% a year, it's become the third largest market cap company in the S&P 500. If you don't have Microsoft doing what it's doing, by the way, trading at 35 times, many turns over its historical average. So right now, we've had the earnings growth, but you've also had multiple expansion in a big, big way around a fundamental narrative. If that doesn't start to play out the way, you know, or if we pulled forward a lot of this performance, at some point you will have a correction in multiples, especially with yields where they are.
Why are we so, we should be happy, shouldn't
I'm always happy. Look at me.
That the markets are doing so well in the face of a fewer rate cuts getting priced in the face of potentially zero rate cuts this year. And where are we still? 5,200 on the S&P 500 and change. So, Guy, why so grim?
Well,
why
this kind of expression on your face? I know you're saying that somewhat tongue-in-cheek.
You
are somewhat wired like I am. But I'll tell you why. Two reasons. Because when I started in this business, one of the first things I learned is hope for the best, prepare for the worst. So that is sort of like a Wall Street mantra, at least when I started. The second point is when we started the show back in 07, 08 and 09 are still, I'm not suggesting we're there, but you know, the fact that people came back and said, you never told us all the bad things were going on. You never warned us. So I vowed from that day on, if I saw things that were, to me at least, alarming, I was going to bring them up. Now, the market has flown in the face of that without question. Similarly, it did that back in 06, 07 into 08, if you recall. There were a lot of warning signs then. So the answer to your question is, things aren't as great as they appear. You know, you look at the employment numbers. Unemployment's still below 4%. But look at the last 10 out of 12 months, the revisions to the downside. You know, there are a lot of things to be concerned about in terms of the consumer. And consumer debt now $17.5 trillion. A lot of warning signs out there that the market right now at least is looking past.
There are still things out there. We always talk about the market is not a monolith, right?
Yes.
There are still definitely pockets of value out there that have sort of set out the rally. And so I think I was expecting to see actually, even on a day like today, which is the beginning of a new quarter, we'll start to see some broadening out. That didn't happen. The reverse of that happened, actually. You saw much bigger strength in, you know, Google, Metas of the world than the IWM or any of the mid-caps. So I don't know. I don't know why that happened today. But I do think that a broadening market, which we do have, is generally better.
Meantime, the 10-year Treasury is trading at almost exactly its average yield over the last 12 months, and the Chartmaster thinks it is about to take the path lower from here. Carter Braxton Worth of Worth Charting joins us now. Carter.
Well, yeah, I mean, here's the thing. I mean, if you were to, we've had these twists and turns, of course, and there's been, oh my God, it'll be 7 cuts, 8 cuts. Now we're not going to have any, or maybe they'll raise. Oh, there's higher for longer. At the end of the day, rather than looking at yields from where they were 12 months ago to where they are now, if one were just to look at the average midpoint in any given day over the past 12 months, yields are exactly where they were 12 months ago. So let's look at this one-year chart of 10-year U.S. Treasury yields. Now let's annotate it. In the second iteration here, and you'll see this line, that if you were to take every single trading day and the midpoint of the range, of course, in any given day, there's a high, there's a low, and there's a close, whether it's a stock or a currency, commodity, or, of course, 10-year Treasury yields. But the average of all days over the past 12 months, from the end of Q1 2023 to the end of Q1 2024, is 4.11%, where you financed or didn't finance, where you acted or didn't act. So looking at it this way, the great fear, and that has been the great fear, right, that rates are going higher and higher, they haven't. And whenever, and history bears this out, whenever you hear a mantra or a turn of phrase that gets coined and embraced and considered sort of gospel, run the other way. One of the biggest phrases, you can Google search it, was higher for longer. That was at 5.02%. We are not at 5.02%. It has not been higher for longer.
All right. Carter, thank you. Carter Braxton-Worth, 4.11. Even if we stayed at 4.11, though, it would still be higher relative to where we had been for longer, potentially. But I get what
Carter's
saying.
Listen, I understand what he's saying. He's looking at it through the lens of 100%. And he's been right more than he's been wrong. I'll say this, though. If you look at the TLT, for example, which is the inverse, but this has been going lower since 2020 or so. We've made a series of lower highs and lower lows. And quite frankly, even with this bounce in the TLT that we've seen recently, with yields going from 5% to 3.8 or so, that is still intact. And if we were to take out sort of this 85 level on the downside in the TLT, which I know seems light years from where we are now, then you're going to have that next leg that I don't think anybody is planning for or expecting.
You know, it's interesting. I don't know if you guys caught over the weekend this manufacturing data out of China, right? So think about this. If they just had the highest data that they had on the PMIs in a year, right, and suggest that they're out of contraction, if the Chinese economy starts to get humming, and if you think you're worried about crude oil that just went from 70 to 80 bucks, if you think you're worried about some of these other commodities that are like, you know, bottom left, upper right, and again, giving the Fed, I think, pause to kind of say, hey, listen, you guys got over your skis with those six expected rate cuts, because that will only kind of, you know, embolden the, you know, like the inflation kind of fears out there. What happens if we get to a point where China has a consecutive swing, you know what I mean, of better data, and we start seeing better demand and inflation readings start to pick up? Then the Fed's quickly going to have to start to move to think about how do we start raising rates again. And at that point, if U.S. growth, if the long and variable lags of all this stuff finally hit, and we finally get that recession, that could be a really tricky spot, I think, for risk assets.
I love it when guests come on the set and just roll their eyes at Dan, because that's exactly
that was
what
amazing. That was amazing. Is that what you call a good segue, Mel?
Great segue. Guess what we're speaking about is Julian Emanuel of Evercore ISI. Julian sees the potential for a volatile April. He's the firm's senior managing director. Julian, great to have you. Whatever you roll, you don't think there's any possibility that the Fed's going to hike?
No.
Is that what you're rolling?
No, it's not an eye roll over what Dan said.
Just Dan
it's
in
the,
general?
No. It's the, okay. Are you kidding? He looks fabulous.
I know. It does.
It's the consequence of even the market thinking there's a possibility of that. And look, I think part of the narrative that's going on now is there's a tendency to say, well, something worked this way, so it's going to work this way again. And look. Frankly, the move from six expected cuts to three was something that we did not expect the market to take as well as it has taken it. But again, like this whole idea of 3% inflation back towards the 2% goal, this last mile is a little bit more difficult. And so, therefore, this idea of three cuts maybe going to two, we don't think the market's going to digest that as easily as it digested the kind of move from six to three, because you're 10% higher. You're on 21 times earnings and expected growth of north of 11% for 2024, which is high by no landing scenario. So we do think there's some volatility ahead.
How does the inflationary sort of readings that we've had when it comes to various commodity prices, services being stickier, et cetera, how does that factor into your view of what the Fed might or might not do?
Well, it made Easter a very expensive holiday this week, given that cocoa's over $10,000 a ton. The Fed has hinted that it's going to give us something that it has literally never given us. Okay, you've had really one cycle where there was cutting into a soft landing, being 1995. And the fact is, that happened when core PCE was already close to 2%. So it's really kind of one of those, a belief that you're going to get that last mile, and we can already look ahead in a week and a half from now. It makes the CPI data unbelievably important, because the narrative is now at the point where, particularly given that momentum stocks have stalled out in the month of March, that's the kind of thing that's a threat to the broader market.
So let me ask you something. If CPI continues to run a little hotter now than we had hoped, and the Fed does nothing, aren't they, in fact, decreasing real rates?
So there's the conundrum, right? You walk this fine line between movements in real rates. And again, we have to understand that based on the last 7 or 8 years, real rates are high. But based on the last 20, they aren't necessarily that high. And remember, I think part of the shock of the last number of months is like, wow, we can actually make money in stocks with interest rates north of 5%. It happened throughout the 1990s. I would suggest is sort of the opposite thing is the problem, is that if the Fed keeps indicating that it looks like two or three cuts, you get the 10-year yield moving sharply higher to discount a longer trajectory of inflation. And that's what bothers stocks more than whether it's three cuts or two cuts.
Julian, your target for the S&P, I think, is 4750 this year. What gets us there?
Look, the environment that we're in now, we've seen a lot of what I would call head-scratching activity on the part of the investing public. FOMO, irrational exuberance, call it whatever you want. But when you're making bets in the options market that the price of a $2 trillion market cap stock is going to double over the next 4 days, there's something going on there. And so from our point of view, this is a time where, again, this is not an end of the bear market, the bull market call, pardon me, that was no pun intended, it's a normal correction of a market that likely goes higher but needs some time to catch up. And that's only going to be a function of if you get disappointing data, because we really are priced for great earnings, great interest rate trajectory, and inflation not being as sticky as it's proven the last couple months.
So, Julian, you're rolling your eyes at me. You got a 4750 target on this thing. I'm helping you get there, buddy. I'm giving you one of the paths to it. No, all right, so let's just talk about that. So that's a 10% move. And we know that in most every year in the S&P 500, there's at least a 10% sort of correction. If you were just to have that sort of move, and it looked a little bit like last July to October. Now, we did have yields going higher during that time period. But let's just say it's just a reset. It's a bit of like taking a bit of the froth out. Would you get more constructive if a lot of the data did not get much hotter or much weaker, either way?
150%.
Yeah.
Basically, this is one of these times, again, and you nailed it, the average non-recession year pullback is 13%. We were spoiled last year. From our point of view, if you get what we expect to come in terms of a market pullback without the probability of a recession becoming more apparent, you absolutely want to get much more positive on the market. And it's been proven, you know, for years on end that that's when you want to buy, not when you want to sell.
All right. Just quickly, April, what is it about April, you think, that makes it traditionally or historically more volatile?
So if you go back to sort of 2000, you've had trading tops and trading bottoms in the March-April timeframe. And what tends to happen is that whatever the momentum is coming into those kind of turns, it flips. What's more pertinent this year is the fact that we've been carried so much psychologically, if nothing else, by those momentum names. We're not the Mag 7, we're the Mag 4, or the Mag 1 or Mag 2 right now, and that's where the vulnerability lies.
All right, Julian, great to see you. Thank you. Julian Emmanuel.
47.50 lines up, I think, right now with where the 200-day moving average is for you playing our home game out there. And we are a couple standard deviations away. And typically the market is mean reversion. But I'll say this quickly. That March 8th, that Friday, March 8th, when we saw all those reversals in single stocks, that has not been violated. Things have gone sideways, slightly higher, slightly lower. But go back and look at that day, the technical setup on the back of that day. And I still think we'll come back in a month or so and say, ah, that was something, Melms.
Coming up, a managed care meltdown going on right in the after hour. Shares of Elevance, United Health, and others plunging after a move out of the centers of Medicare and Medicaid. The headlines from the agency, what it means for these stocks. Plus, Tesla stock coming off a rough first quarter. Now investors are bracing for a potential electric slide when delivery numbers cross the wires. What to expect from that data? Don't go anywhere. Much more Fast Money in two.
This is Fast Money with Melissa Lee. Right here on CNBC.
Wouldn't it be great to have all your investment and retirement accounts in one place? Yahoo Finance, our sponsor today, makes it easy. I use it to put my investment account and 401k accounts into one hub and get expert tips that help me confidently manage my money. For more than 25 years, Yahoo Finance has been the brand behind every great investor. Whether you're a seasoned investor or are looking for that extra guidance, Yahoo Finance gives you all the tools and data you need in one place. They're the number one finance destination, producing a holistic look at the financial news cycle, including breaking news, original editorial perspectives, analyst ratings, independent research, customizable charts, and so much more. Securely link your brokerage accounts for a unified view of your wealth, including 401k and other investments. A comprehensive perspective is what sets apart great investors, and it's how Yahoo Finance ensures you have the insight to look at your wealth in its entirety. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com.
The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid finalizing their rates for Medicare Advantage and Part D programs in 2025, in line with the government's initial proposal, but coming in below Wall Street's expectations. The decision dealing a blow to managed care stocks, which are dropping sharply in the extended hours. For more, we're joined on the fast line by Mizuho healthcare sector strategist Jared Holds. Jared, great to have you with us.
Thanks, Melissa. Appreciate it.
In layperson's term, what does this mean for these stocks?
Well, the Street was expecting a boost from the preliminary rate of about 3.7% or so. A lot of the commentary from the industry suggested that that in this final rate, which came out this evening after the close, that we were going to see 100 basis points, perhaps a little bit more, in relief or in addition to that 3.7%. That does not seem to be the case here. And, you know, as we've discussed so many times, healthcare utilization is running extremely hot now, and these rates are probably not going to cover enough of that for the managed care companies going forward. It's more of a near-term situation. I mean, you know, the rates get reset every year, but at least as we go into fiscal year 2025, I think all of these companies are going to be have their backs against the wall to a degree.
It's Karen. Thanks for being on short notice. So how does this change your view of these companies? I mean, they're all down anywhere from 4 to 8 or 9%. How do you think about them long term?
Hey, Karen. I don't think that much changes. These stocks have been out of favor for the past couple of quarters now, mainly driven by the fact that the procedure volume environment has been so robust. I think what we were kind of hoping for was that a rate increase or a rate change in the positive direction for managed care was going to make the stocks more ownable. And I think what this does in terms of like changing my view and how I think a lot of investors are going to look at it is that the lack of a rate change makes these stocks less ownable, less interesting, especially versus other companies in the sector with more momentum to start with. So now these are kind of anti-momentum or counter-consensus stocks coming into tonight. They're probably going to remain so. And so you're just not going to see, I don't think you're going to see a major bounce tomorrow.
Guidance on utilization rates for the first quarter and for 2025. four as a whole remain high. There was a certain assumption that the utilization rates that were seen in the last reported quarter would remain that high. Could that be sort of the potential upside for the stocks? Is there any evidence that perhaps utilization rates aren't as high?
Yeah, I mean, that is the question. I mean, we're all trying to, you know, gather data points from the industry to kind of give us a better sense of whether utilization rates are going to, you know, stay at current rates, whether they're going to drop, whether they're going to even get stronger from here. You know, there have been a lot of medical meetings, a lot of broker conferences over the past couple of months, and a lot of those data points kind of suggest that we're going to stay at these elevated volumes for a while. So maybe that's the first quarter of this year, the second quarter into the second half of the year. I mean, at some point, I would think that we kind of normalize just because we have not seen this level of strength in a long time, but it's so difficult to predict. A lot of it is based on just behavioral. Some of it's based on the economy and the job market. And obviously, all of those variables are tough to predict in isolation. I would just think that based on what we think we know, we're going to see this utilization environment continue at least through the early summer.
All right. Jared, thanks so much for joining us by phone. We do appreciate your analysis last minute. Jared Holz of Mizuho. Karen, you own Elevance still?
I do, yeah. And I take some comfort, which I should take none, in that it's down the least, but 4%. I'm not delighted with that. And you know what? Everything he's saying about do you want to own these, actually, probably not. And just a mistake I made, you know, owned it much lower, which is an irrelevant piece of information. I should probably just sell it.
Humana quickly. I mean, that's been the leader to the downside. So real quick, Melms, if we can go back to September of 2018, at the time the stock was making an all-time high around 330 or so, then we cascaded lower. The levels we're at right now, actually lower now, but this is huge support level, so it's got to hold. And quickly for UNH, I mean, the double top now is firmly in place, 452, which I think was a low, I want to say in June or so of 2022, critical that it holds that level.
There's a lot more Fast Money to come. Here's what's coming up next.
The ABCs of dividends. Why one top analyst says Alphabet could be ready to start paying back shareholders and what it could mean for the stock. Next, plus yakking on the yen, Japan's currency at a pivotal juncture, and central bankers are eyeing the moves. Could there be an intervention ahead? You're watching Fast Money live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. We're back right after this.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you. Like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Tesla continuing its rocky start to the year, dropping as much as 3% at its lows of the day. This as investors await the EV maker's Q1 delivery numbers. CNBC's Phil LeBeau joins us now to dive into the estimates, which have been coming down of late, Phil.
They have been, Melissa. And the question now is, will Tesla post a year-over-year decline in deliveries? We haven't seen that in quite some time, at least 4 or 5 years since we've seen that from Tesla. Here's the latest consensus from FactSet, 457,000. I have to be clear here. That was the consensus last updated by FactSet on Friday. Since then, a slew of reports have come out. People are now saying, look, 415 to 420 is what we think. In fact, when you look at the analyst notes, Wedbush is at 425. That's Dan Ives. Then you've got Morgan Stanley at 425. Adam Jonas there. And Emmanuel Rosner at Deutsche Bank. He's coming in at 414. Bottom line is the analysts have all been bringing down their estimates, not just for the first quarter, and we'll talk about why that's the case, but also for the full year. It's more than common now that you will see analysts saying when it comes to full year deliveries, we don't think that they're going to get the 2 million. They were at 1.81 million last year. I've seen a couple of analysts say if they get to 1.91 million, We think that's what we can expect for the rest of this year. So as you take a look at shares of Tesla, the bottom line is this. The competition in China has been brutal. That has hurt deliveries there. There have been problems with the Gigafactory over in Europe, as well as demand in Europe. And then here in the U.S., it's a softer EV market. Just look at what they're doing when it comes to full self-driving. They're now offering Tesla owners a one-month free trial. You never saw that in the past. That's not only for Tesla owners currently, because full self-driving, as far as a subscription service, is crucial to the bottom line when they report their quarterly results. But it's also one way to sweeten the pot a bit to say to people, do the other guys have full self-driving? We think we have the superior product. Come with us if you're considering buying an electric vehicle. So we think we'll get the numbers before the bell tomorrow, Melissa. That's what history tells us. If we do, we'll have them for you on Squawk Box.
Sure you will. Phil, thank you. Phil LeBeau. 3 days after the quarter end is the sort of the Tesla rule here. It would be the first year-on-year decline, by the way, since the second quarter of 2020. Mm-hmm. Which would be remarkable.
Real quick. So I think it was the October quarter of last year when the market thought trough margins came in like at 17 and a half handle. But that was it. That's the low we're going to see. And the stock acted in kind. I think it went from 195 close to 300 or so over the next couple of months. We're obviously lower now. What's proved to be the case is that wasn't trough margins. Margins have actually sort of flatlined. So if you have price wars and continue to cut prices and demand's not there, margins are going to continue to contract. And that was one of the sort of the pillars of the bull case, you know, the margin expansion. It's not happening, Mills.
You know, it's interesting. And again, when we were in this AI moment last year, before people really knew like where to kind of place their bets, I think Tesla was benefiting from that. Obviously, Elon Musk was early in OpenAI. This is something that he's talked a lot about. If you think about full self-driving being such an important part of this story, it's not just about EVs, right? It's about that recurring revenue, and it's about that thing to get people hooked on their platform, if you will. It's just not there, right? So that's part of the story. And I just think it's interesting right now, we're spending so much time on two things, margins and deliveries, the same sort of thing that you would focus on GM and Ford and other automakers. And that's where this stock is right now. But unfortunately, I think for the longs, if you do have two consecutive negative quarters of deliveries, which I think some analysts are expecting right now, this stock goes lower because then it really, unless there's some big FSD breakthrough or something like that, because the demand picture and the competitive picture, in my opinion, doesn't really change a whole heck of a lot for the next couple of months. And let me tell you another thing. We haven't even had a recession. When you talk about that period, the last two times they had, you know, no demand. Well, that was in 2020 during a pandemic.
And we haven't talked about the dynamic in China in terms of the competitors there.
Correct.
BYD.
Well, we've actually been talking about that. For like a year, we've been talking about that, actually.
This conversation in terms of the litany of reasons why. No, I mean, that comes on the show like every other day, I would say, in terms of the China dynamic of them cutting prices, the local homegrown brands, while Tesla's raising prices in China.
Yeah, we were talking about before. What was that about? It's sort of confusing to me. So I think the question Dan brings it up is, you know, if we look at like an auto company, what is the right multiple? Is it the GM multiple, which is 5 or something like that? Well, then there's still a lot of multiple that needs some explaining, right? And if it's FSD, they don't seem to be far enough along. Now, granted, they've been saying this for 3 years. Just mathematically, we have to be closer.
Right.
But I don't know how front and center that is.
Coming up, land of the rising sun, but falling yen. More on Japan's currency issues and how central bankers could be getting involved. The details next. Plus, what could Alphabet do with all its cash? One top analyst says a dividend might be in its future. What's it mean for the stock and the sector? Fast Money's back in two. Welcome back to Fast Money. Stocks kicking off Q2 trading with some mixed action. The Dow falling 240 points, the S&P down by 0.2%, and the tech-heavy Nasdaq capturing a small gain. Some of the casino stocks getting a boost. Gaming revenue in Macau surging in March, boosted by this longer holiday weekend. And some after-hours action to bring you shares of PVH plunging after its earnings report. The company posting a beat on the top and the bottom line, but reporting weaker than expected outlook. And we're watching shares of Disney. T. Rowe Price saying it has voted in favor of the company's board of directors, a blow to Tryon and Blackwell's activist bid. T. Rowe owns just over 9 million shares of Disney. The company holds its shareholder meeting on Wednesday. Meantime, the Japanese yen falling against the U.S. dollar today, trading close to a 34-year low. the country's finance minister defending the currency, saying that, quote, there are some speculative moves that do not reflect fundamentals when taking into account domestic and overseas economic as well as price developments. Still, with the yen down more than 7% just this year, our next guest says the best move for the Bank of Japan is to raise rates rather than intervene in the currency market. Jens Nordvig, founder and CEO of Exante, joins us now. Jens, always great to see you. Your name is so fitting for this conversation. I'm sure you get that all the time. But in terms of raising rates, that's really sort of a tricky thing for the BOJ, even if it seems like the easiest thing to do. I mean, to put that sort of squeeze on the economy when so many of its mortgages are tied to floating rates, that could really hurt.
Yeah, it's a tricky situation they're facing, right? Because they're saying that the yen is not in line with fundamentals, but actually, you can see what's going on in the rest of the world, right? The dollar is strong, and now they managed to hold it for a week or two at this level. So I would actually argue that it's getting out of whack, right, because of this verbal intervention. So eventually they have to decide whether they put money on the table. In 2022, it cost them $60 billion to intervene for a couple of days, right? So it's not cheap to intervene. But if they don't intervene, I think we're going to break high on dollar yen. It's just going to follow the global dollar trend that we're seeing. And the better option would be to say, okay, finally, the Japanese economy is emerging from deflation, right? And they can actually move rates. They obviously moved rates from slightly negative to zero in March, but really the big step is to actually go into positive. And that probably would be the right move in the next couple of months rather than spending lots of billions of dollars on intervention that's not going to have a lot of long-term impact.
Jens, I'm not suggesting we're on the precipice of, but the weaker this gets, the yen, the more you're going to start hearing about, you know, currency crisis and what they have to do. They're clearly in a pickle here. Raised rates are obviously hurting the economy. Let the yen continue to weaken. That hurts their citizenry, and it also obviously hurts the things they export in. It just becomes more expensive. Speak to that. At what point are people going to be saying, you know what, this weaker yen's a problem?
Yeah, I think on raising rates being a huge problem for the economy, like, we can debate that. Like, interest rates are zero, right? Bank lending is actually very strong in Japan. Bank lending is growing very strongly, better than most economies around the world, right? So we've seen economies around the world like stomach a little bit higher rates, probably better than most people thought. We have 5.5 in the U.S. and the economy is still kind of growing, right? So maybe the Japanese economy will be okay with 0.5% or 1%. So I think there's a fear of raising rates because they've obviously been in zero rate or lower environment for several decades now. But I think they need to break out of that psychology. I think the right move would be to get off zero in the next couple of months instead of spending like billions of dollars intervening for just a short-term effect.
If they did intervene, Jens, what would the line in the sand be for them? 155? 154,
well, they've been trying to hold it here just below 152 for 2 weeks. They've had some success talking about it and getting it to stick there, but eventually they'll have to back it up. And I think we will see volatility one way or the other. Either they come in and intervene and we have, like, you know, the big down up we typically see, or they let it go through 152, and that's going to generate some follow through, including probably the Chinese currency, where they seem to be watching it closely and also holding that at the moment. So important time right here.
Jens, thank you. Jens Nordvig of Exante. Last time BOJ intervened was October 2022.
Yeah. And, I mean, the interventions don't, I mean, they work for a couple days. I mean, right. Raising rates, though, I mean, they raise rates, the yen weakened. They can raise rates some more. The market's going to call them. I'm one of these few people, I think, believe the yen will continue to weaken, which theoretically, I think a lot of people say that's a risk-on thing. I think that's going to be a huge risk-off thing at a certain level, and I think we're precariously close to it.
Yeah. Coming up, don't look now, but Alphabet shares are back at all-time highs. The headline's taking the stock higher today. How much more gas may have left in the tank? That is next, plus trouble for Trump. Trump media shares plunging after the Truth Social parent reported a huge loss for 2023. Inside the eye-popping numbers and whether the former president's company can maintain its valuation right after this. Welcome back to Fast Money. Shares of Alphabet soaring to all-time highs today on some optimistic analyst calls. Bank of America naming the Mag 7 laggard a top pick for the new quarter, and Evercore ISI's Mark Mahaney saying on Squawk this morning that he now prefers the stock to Meta and sees a potential for a dividend.
What I'm struck by with Google is that you know, there's a couple of things that I think are very fixable on their part in terms of their cost structure, in terms of actually paying a dividend. Wouldn't be hard for them to do that with $100 billion in cash. And then I think it's underappreciated as an AI asset.
So are the stars finally aligning for Gemini and Google? Karen, you sure hoping?
I am sure hoping. However, I hope that doesn't mean something bad for Meta, because that actually is my larger position. But I mean, this, as Mark talks about, this is really actually ridiculously cheap for a company like this that generates the kind of cash that they do and loses the kind of cash they do on other things. If you ever got that back, that would be great. But the dividend thing, that would sort of be interesting. I was surprised how much Meta went up on that when they did. So I guess that would be good. Big buyback would also be good. And I hope they're through the just disastrous rollout and then the disastrous image gate, whatever that was. And, you know, I said around this thing today on market share, search market share, and, you know, all calls of it being completely decimated have yet to happen. So hopefully it'll start getting a little bit more credit. It's the cheapest of the bunch by a fair amount.
I mean, I guess the big news would be, if it comes, it was rumored a couple of weeks ago, if they were to do a deal with Apple, okay, licensing Gemini and basically processing a lot of those sort of like language model searches in their cloud. I mean, that would be massive. If you think of the 2 billion installed base, and who knows if that's going to happen. If it's going to happen, it's likely to be announced before Worldwide Developers Forum in early June. And so that's one of the reasons why when you get this sort of technical setup, you get the valuation support, you get the sentiment, which has been really bad in this name. If all that stuff can line up with a big announcement with Apple, then this thing's off to the races.
Coming up, another big swing for Trump's media stock. DJT plunging as the company reveals more troubling losses, the going concern notice, and what it could mean for the former president's payout. More Fast Money in two. Welcome back to Fast Money. The parent company of former President Donald Trump's social media platform, Truth Social, lost more than $58 million last year, while bringing in just over $4 million in revenue, according to new SEC filings today. Shares of Trump Media and Technology Group sliding more than 20% today. A sharp pullback after last week's run. This comes as the board debates whether to grant Trump a waiver on a six-month lockup period. For more, let's bring in Dan Primack. He's the business editor over at Axios. Dan, great to have you with us. I was sort of surprised at this decline, because I didn't know that the metrics were all that surprising that we learned about today. What was your reaction?
Yeah, I agree. It's almost like there were certain people who woke up and thought, oh, wow, it's a bad business. I mean, of course it's a bad business. We knew it was a bad business through the first three quarters. I mean, maybe there were certain people who thought there was going to be some Q4 momentum. And I do think that maybe was part of it. It wasn't just that the business isn't good. It somehow got worse in the fourth quarter than it was in the third quarter of last year in terms of revenue. It only brought in about $750,000 in Q4 last year, top line, which is just an extraordinarily low amount, given that they do have a few million users.
Yeah, it's Karen. So what do you think what happened today? As Melissa said, it seems odd that people would wake up and go, oh, my God, the financials are terrible. Do you think it was that language about going concern, which I think is somewhat dated, that language, since the merger actually closed post the time that that auditor made that statement?
Yeah, it may have been. There were a couple of news reports that pointed that out. But as you say, those were old. It would have problems as a going concern if the merger isn't completed, because these were auditors, you know, at year end last year. The merger was completed. There is cash there, you know, from the SPAC merger. There is cash there. So going concern for a while shouldn't be an issue. I mean, you know, to be honest, part of this is maybe the memeiest of all meme stocks ever. So the idea that it's going to have a big up or a big down probably shouldn't surprise us that much.
All right, so Dan, I think it's still a $5.5 billion market cap company that, let's just say, to round, they'll do $5 million of revenue-ish. What is the right price to sales multiple given some of the comps out there? And then, you know, back of the envelope, this thing.
Wait, are you saying you don't think 1,000 to 1 is a proper ratio? Because I think that's where we're at right now, right? I mean, I don't think you can judge this by comps. In fact, to be honest, Truth Social or Trump Media, in its own disclosures today, it pointed out that it's not going to release any of its user data in terms of average user or average revenue per user, DAUs, MAUs, any of these things, downloads that any of their comps do. I don't think there are comps here. This is, do you want to buy Donald Trump and help him either reputationally or financially, or don't you?
Hey, Dan, when I look at the holders of this company, as we often do, right, when we look at publicly traded companies, I see that, you know, the former president owns 58% of this thing. And we know that they're trying to get this lockup kind of, you know, abbreviated. He owns the board, that sort of thing. I have to assume that there are some real institutional holders here that have a fiduciary responsibility, right? They might not have any voting rights on this sort of thing, but I have to assume that this is going to end, like a lot of other Trump dealings, in a lot of lawsuits.
I would agree. Just on that first point, I don't know, at least my reporting hasn't shown that they are trying to get the lockup reduced. The assumption is they are, but Devin Nunes was on the CEO was on a show the other day and said there's been no conversations like that. Yeah, people do have fiduciary duty. There are, I think if I was an investor, if I was a client of some of the bigger holdings here, I'd be making a phone call and having simply a question, why? What is it about this that you actually think is going to appreciate, particularly for folks who bought in last week when the stock ticker changed and it started trading not as DWAC, but as DJT?
Yep. So many questions. Dan, thank you. Fascinating story, though. Dan Permick of Axios. Up next, final trades. Time for the final trade. Let's go around the horn, Karen.
Yes, so we've had this meaningfully big move in rates. I think it's time to cover some TLT. Maybe I'll get a chance later to put it back out again.
Dan?
Yeah, I like that Google conversation. And the way you think about it, if you were to get a dividend, that probably would be something good. I wouldn't love to see a buyback, though, but that one looks like it could be off to the races with any good news.
Okay.
Big sports night, Mel, as you know, we talked about. I mean, the Rangers are playing.
Well, we got
the
Mets basketball.
That's the exact. Yeah. See,
okay.
Karen knows.
Of course I know.
The LSU Tigers are taking on the Hawkeyes of Iowa tonight. That's must-watch TV. I'll be watching. ExxonMobil. Everybody hated it at 98. Everybody loves it now. Exxon.
Thanks for watching Fast. See you back here tomorrow at 5 for more Fast Mad Money with Jim Cramer starts right now.
All opinions expressed by the Fast Money participants are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of CNBC, NBC Universal, their parent company or affiliates, and may have been previously disseminated by them on television, radio, internet, or another medium. You should not treat any opinion expressed on this podcast as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of an opinion. Such opinions are based upon information the Fast Money participants consider reliable, but neither CNBC nor its affiliates and or subsidiaries warrant its completeness or accuracy, and it should not be relied upon as such. To view the full Fast Money disclaimer, please visit cnbc.com/fastmoneydisclaimer.
You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.